Espionage, conspiracies, terrorists, and secret governments are the stuff of Robert Ludlum's international thrillers. Ludlum likes to keep his readers in suspense. Book critic John Leonard once wrote, "Ludlum tells his story like a man who must get it done before the house burns down around us. I sprained my wrists turning his pages." Most of Ludlum's books make it onto the bestseller lists. Some of his best-known novels are The Bourne Identity, The Parsifal Mosaic, and The Holcroft Covenant. Ludlum's book The Osterman Weekend was made into a film directed by Sam Peckinpah. Robert Ludlum's new book, The Icarus Agenda, is set in the Middle East and in Washington, D.C. A group of Arab terrorists seize the American embassy, and an American congressman attempts to infiltrate the terrorists by posing as one himself. I spoke with Robert Ludlum from the NPR Bureau in New York, and I asked him if the story of the Icarus Agenda was inspired by real events.
No, not really. Contrary to what a lot of people think, and especially since my name was used so frequently during the Iran scam hearings, I believe Senator Rudman stood in the Capitol steps and said, "If Robert Ludlum had written this, I'd believe it, but not as fact." But I can assure you, no, it is not based on any particular event, and I finished the novel before the Iran scam hearings. I just want to get that out of the way, Terry, okay?
Good enough. Well, speaking of the Iran-Contra hearings, though, did that make you think that truth is stranger than fiction?
No, it just sort of convinced me that my paranoia was not exactly, unrequited, as it were.
Well, you've been writing about secret governments for some time.
Yes, I have. I think one of my themes is the abuse of power, both elected and appointed.
There are secret governments. There are also, like, individual fanatics that you write about.
Yeah.
Do you think
that
kind of fanaticism and those kinds of secret governments don't choose sides, that they are to be found in all in all political sides throughout the world?
Well, I think there's always a fringe, a lunatic fringe, on anything that is so absolute that does not consider the other fellow's point of view. In other words, people who don't want to negotiate are going to be fanatical. It's really a kind of a, you know, either or. You're either my way or else you're not. And that's the kind of blind thinking that I find so abhorrent, and that's why I write about it, I guess.
Now, your main character in the Icarus Agenda mm-hmm. is a fairly unassuming guy, especially at the beginning, and he's someone who doesn't want a lot of attention.
Well, he's somebody who is not ambitious in the political sense, and that's why I might as well tell you that the reason why this book came about was that there are two existing realities that I loathe. One is the senseless violence of the Middle East. And it doesn't matter, you know, whose imprimatur is where or what territory belongs to whom, because there are all sides to all stories. But we're all human underneath. And how can they continue, both sides, with this extraordinary animalism? That's one thing I loathe. The other thing I loathe is what I call the manipulation of the body politic. Now, I'm talking about this country because I live here. We have the best system, I think, in the world, but nevertheless, there are the corruptors. And that's another thing I don't like. We're told things are one way, and you peel the layers away, and we find out it's something else. So I thought that if I could tell the story of one man crossing from one world into another, both parts of these worlds that I find outrageous, I thought it would make a more meaningful, possibly more powerful book. I jumped ahead like this because I think I'm anticipating some of your questions.
Okay, good enough.
I didn't mean that in a pejorative sense
no,
at all.
No, no,
you
no,
know
no,
that.
No, no, no.
Yeah.
There are hostages and fanatics in your book, and this might be an absurd question, but, you know, I was wondering if you actually ever called up any people who had been taken hostage to see what it felt like from their perspective.
No, but I know several.
You know people who have been hostages,
yes.
And you've spoken
not
to them
particularly
about it?
in this area of what I wrote about, but I know people who have been taken hostage, and I have talked with them. But mainly, it's imagination. It's not hard to imagine yourself as a hostage. And you know, if anybody's ever been in the Marine Corps, ask them.
Well, how about this? You also, I mean, there are people who get shot in your book, and you try to imagine what it would feel like. You know,
well, I was in World War II.
Were you ever shot?
No.
Do you ever wonder what it would feel like to be shot?
Well, of course, don't we all?
Yeah, I've dreamt about it many times
no,
myself,
I don't, no,
to tell
I
you
mean
the truth.
That, but I mean, you know, when you read about the violence that's taking place, you've got to put yourself in a victim's shoes every now and then. You can't help it. It's human nature to think, my God, what must it be like? I have been severely hurt. Yes, we all have, and the human condition can't take it. It's one of the reasons why there's no protagonist or no real character in any of my books that is severely wounded and gets up in the next chapter and chases the Indians. I mean, the human condition can't take that, and I try to explain that. I think one of the nicest things that somebody said about the violence in my books was that after you read a violent scene in one of Ludlum's books, the last thing you want to do is go out and get in a fight. And I think that's that. I thought that was a nice compliment.
Well, someone else once pointed out about your books that the main character is usually on the verge of exhaustion.
Yeah, sure, because you can't go through what I put a character through and not be exhausted. I was watching a film the other night on television, a late night film, and here was a guy running up a hill. He was doing all the Rambo nonsense you can think of, and he walks into the next scene and he talks like he's just had a cocktail down at Larry's bar. I mean, it's unbelievable how they... No, the human condition can't take that. When you're hurt, you're hurt. You don't recover that quickly.
Novelist Robert Ludlum is my guest, and his new thriller is called The Icarus Agenda. Now, you know, this brings to mind James Bond, and I say that because Bond was one of the early, post-World War II espionage heroes. Did you ever...
Well, that's early for you, dear. Yes. Children, my God, they're all children.
Did you read a lot of Ian Fleming before you started writing?
No, I had read none of Ian Fleming, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, because his writing isn't much like yours at all.
No, I don't think so. Now, I think what he does, he did superbly. Now that I've, in later years, I've read much of what he did. And I read it mainly because I ran into a fellow named William Stevenson, who was known as the man called Intrepid, for whom Ian Fleming worked. And when they were forming British intelligence, those people in Canada. And that's how I began to read Ian Fleming. And I was amazed at how accurate he was in some of the things that he detailed in an almost comic fashion. And yet I knew from doing whatever minor research I was capable of that, my God, they were accurate. And then somebody pointed out to me, well, yes, he was there.
You know, one thing that always stuck in my mind about the Ian Fleming novels is that the James Bond character was always in jeopardy. He was always on the verge of being sadistically tortured.
Yes, he did. But I think there was a wonderful sort of, tongue-in-cheek attitude to the way Fleming wrote on those things, and I thought it was delightful.
Now, there's American and British traditions of espionage writing. Do you think there are any differences between the way Americans like yourself and the way the British writers like Le Carré write about the subject, the genre?
Yeah, I think there's a difference. I think that they can be more obviously cerebral than some of the American writers of the genre that I have been identified with. Cerebral in the sense of introspection. I try to show introspection without really talking about it that much. But they have their doubts, their self-doubts, are expressed more voluminously than I do. I try to do it in quick brushstrokes so that you see the pain through the introspection, because I think if somebody is that introspective, he wouldn't be in the business he's in. And that's why I do it my way.
I think the genre's changed a lot since the end of World War II.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think we've suddenly become taken a little bit more seriously, which I'm not sure is a good thing, but,
why not? Why not?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, why not? Yeah, surely. I'm a professional,
Do you have inside sources that you cultivate in the CIA or in government who give you interesting information?
Oh, yeah, there's Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny and... No, not really. I must say that several people I went to college with have ended up in Allied intelligence circles, and they still remain great friends of mine. I've never asked them, nor would they violate anything, but sometimes if I'll call them up to just say, hey, blank, what do you think about so-and-so? And if they laugh too hard, then I figure I'm getting near a target. But that's about it. I know. It's mainly imagination. William Stevenson, again, Intrepid, once said that the success of deep cover intelligence under severe stress, read violence, its success is determined by the use of extreme imagination under severe stress. And if you think through that, you can put yourself in those positions, or in that position, plural, that But you can imagine. Your imagination will take over from there.
Now, I asked you a little bit about Le Carré and Ian Fleming. Do you read much of Tom Clancy, and I wonder what you think of his books?
No, I haven't, and I really do want to, but I have not read Mr. Clancy's work, only because I've been working. And while
maybe it's so you wouldn't have to comment on programs like this.
No. I wouldn't. In the first place, you know, the literary vineyards, if I may use the word loosely, is such a wide one. I have no negative comments about people in my profession because I know how hard we work. If I find that there's someone whose work I don't appreciate, this is not a case in point, by the way, but if I find there's a work of a contemporary of mine that I don't really appreciate, I simply have never read him. But in this case, no, I honestly haven't. My wife has read him and finds him delightful. But I just haven't had time because last 3 or 4 years, I've been working rather hard.
Your novels are very intricately plotted. Do you arrange them elaborately on index cards or large maps before you set about actually writing the book?
Oh, no, I'm too dumb for that. No. What I do is that I will start with an outline, and it can go anywhere from 50 to 100 pages, and then with a couple of initial scenes. And then a lot of the book will depend on the development of the characters as they are developed, as I develop them. They'll have certain strengths, certain weaknesses, vulnerabilities, and that will help shape where I'm going. The complexity is deliberate. I do not think the life isn't simple. And as a result, I don't stay away from complexity for fear that I'm going to be confusing someone, because I think people are much smarter than that. I think readers don't mind complexity, and I guess they don't. I do not simplify for the sake of simplification. I think that's kind of pretentious.
I read in one place that you ran away from home at the age of 14 to join the Marines, to lie about your age and join the Marines. And another place I read that at the age of 14 you ran away to be in the theater. I'm not sure if either of those things are true.
Well,
so maybe
there's a grain of truth in all of it, but it's like today everybody says what a successful actor I was. Well, that is totally nonsense. I mean, I barely survived as an actor. But it's true. I did not run away from home. I left home. And I left home originally to go on the stage. I was in Junior Miss and Janie in the Chicago, New York companies. And it's true that I did not join the Marines then. What I did was I tried to enlist in the Royal Canadian Air Force. And I was using another name. I was using the name of Holmes because anyway, I used the name of Holmes, and I was in the recruitment center in Toronto. I'd left the show and had my understudy take over. And by that time, there was word out on me, and somebody shouted out, "Ludlam?" I said, "Yes, no, out." That was the end of my career in the RCAF. I did, however, the next year, I went back to school, and I did, however, the next year, enlist in the Marines. I think it was on the day before my 17th birthday or something like that. I was in prep school and simply decided that, you know, everybody else was winning the war. Why can't I? And so I joined the Marines at 17.
Why did you want to get in the Marines? Because to win the war or to be in the action?
Yeah, I think so. I think at that age, you know, everything was so hyped up and, you know, we didn't like those other guys. I mean, we had a cause, a reason. And I just felt left out, and I wanted to get in as soon as possible. My mother was not terribly pleased with the idea, which is why I sort of did it surreptitiously. And I did send her a postcard from Paris Island, but
that's very nice.
I thought so, yeah. Good son, yeah.
So did you see much action?
No. I don't go into that. I was in the South Pacific, but in such a minor way compared to other people, I don't even, you know, don't go into it. It's silly.
I guess I shouldn't assume that much of the action in your novels is based on your experience while in the Marines.
No, not that much. No, a certain amount of the hand-to-hand stuff. Yeah, but that's because I taught it for a while. I don't think I was very good at it, frankly. I think it was just because I'm 5'10½". I'm not one of the big guys, and they used to choose guys our size to teach that stuff because if a big guy went down, the other guys would get confidence. Boy, I still hurt thinking about that.
Robert Ludlam is my guest, and his new novel is called The Icarus Agenda. His other novels include The Osterman Weekend, The Aquitaine Progression, The Mattery Circle, and The Bourne Identity. We're going to talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Robert Ludlum is my guest. His new novel, titled The Icarus Agenda. Well, you mentioned before that you started your career as an actor, and I must say, you really have a terrific voice. What kind of roles did you play when you were acting?
I either played homicidal killers or lawyers, and I've always thought there was a very definite connection. I was the guy that sent Siobhan McKenna to the stake in St. John, and he was a lawyer, of course. And then the next show I did on television, I can't even remember the name of the show now, but I think I was considered schizophrenic, paranoid, dangerous, and I'm not sure I was electrocuted, but I certainly should have been. I think both for the acting and the role, but nevertheless, it was.
Now, you did commercial voiceovers for a while, too, right?
Yeah, I know. It's morally one step below theft, but when you have a couple of kids in college, it doesn't hurt. No.
What kind of commercials did you do the voicing for?
Let's see. You know, there's so many that you do, and there's so many that you try out for. You're never quite sure. I do know that I was the voice of Braniff Airlines. You remember, you'll like flying Braniff style. And then, of course, there was the one years ago. I think I did it. I'm not sure, but should a gentleman offer a lady a tipperillo? And then, of course, there was the plunge works fast. Let's not go into that. But no, it was thanks to a lovely agent. You know, people kept saying to me when I was an actor, boy, you'd make a terrific producer. And I got the message, you know, get off the stage. And so I did and became a producer. But when I did make the switch to, when I decided I really wanted to spend full time as a writer, to which my wife, who's a superb actress, thought she won. She immediately thought she'd have to go back to work. She said, well, you're 40 years of age, Robert, and you might as well try it now, no matter how impoverished we may be. But I did have the voiceovers going, and I'm eternally grateful for it.
So you stuck with the voiceovers for a while to tide you over when you started writing?
Yeah, I did. But when my first book came out, I never again did them. In the first place, I wouldn't take a job from an actor. And secondly, an awful lot of actors, if I'd walk in and do for an audition, you know, I might be hung out the window. So I didn't do that anymore.
Did people used to recognize your voice?
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Well, it was embarrassing?
No, not embarrassing. But they'd say, don't I know you? And I'd say, I don't think so. Say, I'm sure I know you. And I knew what they were thinking of. You know, I had just sold Tuna Helper to them 45 times or something, you know. But or Hamburger Helper, whatever that was, I don't know.
So when you dropped acting at age 40, what made you think you could actually write?
Well, I've been writing. I've been a closet writer for years. When I was coming back from the South Pacific, I wrote a book that I'm afraid on discharge, myself and several friends over-imbibed at the Top of the Mark in San Francisco, and I lost an 800-page manuscript. And to this day, I say to people, they say, my God, you've really lost a manuscript like that size? And I always say, yeah, you never remembered Naked and the Dead? I don't think Norman really appreciates that story, but it's true.
Why did you want to write international thrillers? Why did you start with that?
I didn't really start thinking I'm going to do that. And to this day, I don't label myself. I think I write suspense fiction. But then, you know, so is the Iliad and the Odyssey. I think it probably comes from the theater. Suspense. If you don't want to know what happens in Act Two after Act One, your play's going to close and you're going to be on the unemployment line next Monday. And my unemployment number was 1344. I'll never forget it. So I think that idea of suspense comes from a theatrical background, from the theatrical experience.
Well, speaking of your theatrical experience, were you able to use acting in character development, since you knew about what it meant to get inside a character and how a character needed to be developed?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think so particularly, you know, consciously. I think that's just part of where I come from. That, you know, if you're going to try to get inside the head of somebody, I suppose you act it out in your imagination. I mean, I don't go around shouting Arabic or something like that, or Hebrew when I'm trying to describe something in the Middle East, but yeah, you try to get in the heads of people, and you try to use the only tool you've got, which is imagination.
Do you think that you write roles that you could play? Would you like to act the role of some of your main characters?
I think some of my actor friends would probably throw up at the thought, but but nevertheless, I've been offered a number of roles since I became a writer, much more than I was ever offered as an actor. But no, I don't really think so. One, I couldn't take work from an actor. You know, they work too hard for a living. But no, I don't have any great desire to act again, no, no.
Writer Robert Ludlum is my guest, his new book titled The Icarus Agenda. Well, I'm hardly the first person to point out that just about every one of your books has a three-word title.
Yes.
The Bourne Supremacy, yeah. The Aquitaine Progression, The Parsifal Mosaic, yeah. The Bourne Identity, The Mattery Circle, and on and on.
Yeah, well, I can tell you how it happened if you want to
know.
Yeah,
would you?
Yeah, the third or fourth book I wrote, the first book was Scarlatti Inheritance, the second, I think, was The Osterman Week, and the third was Matlock Paper. Now, those were three-word titles because I felt they made sense. And I walked in with my fourth book, the publishers, and the title was Cable Tortugas. And here were these six people sitting around the table and looked at me like they were crying and weeping, and I said, my God, is it that bad? And they said, no, no, not the book. The book's all right, but the title. I said, what's wrong with the title? I mean, it says it. And they said, oh, no, you're identified with the three-word title. I said, what do you mean identified with a I'm not identified with a popsicle, for heaven's sakes. Nobody knows who I am. They said, oh, no. And somebody in the New York Times had said I was identified. Well, you know, if it was in the New York Times, naturally, they got to believe it, you know. And so I said, okay, fellas, now, wait a minute. Stop crying. I said, now, this whole book is about an exchange, right? I mean, diamonds for gyroscopes. And they said, yeah, an exchange. And I said, a guy who does it named Reinman, right? And they said, yes. And I said, how about the Reinman exchange? Oh, thank you. And I thought, oh, my God, it's the silliest day I've ever spent in my life. But ever since then, they've wanted the three-word titles, and now it's become a game for me. I enjoy doing it, and I've seen people who've tried to, use three-word titles. And I think one of the funniest ones was the Massapequa Massacre that somebody put out. For me, the simplest with the meaning behind it. And I said to my agent once about 4 or 5 years ago, I said, what do you say I change a title and not a three-word title? And he began to cry. And I said, okay, forget it. I won't. I'll go three-word title. I mean, you know, they pay me very well, and it's the least I can do for them.
But how did you first start writing three-word titles?
I don't know. It just seemed when I was writing about a guy named Scarlatti, and he was bankrolling the Nazi Party from his inheritance, it seemed logical to me to call it the Scarlatti Inheritance. And when I was writing about a weekend of four couples, and where in the catalyst of it was a man named Osterman, it seemed quite logical to me to call it the Osterman Weekend. And the Matlock Paper, there was a paper that could do all kinds of things. A piece of paper, the POP, that some critics write about, and I certainly didn't invent, neither did Conan Doyle. I think it goes back to the Phrygians or something, but I thought that, you know, that's the paper that's going to explode everything. The guy, the protagonist was Matlock. Why not the Matlock paper? Then along came the Reinman exchange, but actually the whole thing of the book was Cable Tortugas. The thing is going to blow apart. No, it didn't work. You know, they wanted the Reinman exchange. But no, it's never been a conscious thing. It wasn't then. It is now. Now I know that, and I sympathize with them.
It's your duty to do it now.
Well, yeah, duty because they're nice people. And why not? And I think I'm a nice person, so we can compromise on this.
Didn't you write a couple of books under a pseudonym?
Yeah, I can talk about one of them, which is...
One of them you're not even revealing?
No, two of them I can't, because I think we're in court. I don't know, but something like that, they tell me. But one of them was The Road to Gandolfo, which was a pure farce comedy. And that was originally put out under the name of Michael Shepard, because I had a crazy shepherd dog then, and one of my son's names is Michael, and that's why I called it. Michael Shepard was the author.
Since your name sells so many books, why would you want to change it?
Because I wrote it, one, it was a farce comedy, far away from anything I'd done. I did it because a screenwriter friend of mine said, if you wrote a thriller about the kidnapping of the Pope, X said I could do the screenplay and this and that. He's a great friend, and so I said to him, no, that can't be a thriller. You know that you could do that in the 16th, 17th centuries, but not now. I mean, it just doesn't work. And so I persisted in my thought that it had to be a comedy, and he had tried it the other way and it didn't work. And so he said, please, try it your way. And I began writing it, and frankly, it's just what I said in the preface when they released it under my own name. I began writing it, and I just had so much fun doing it, because I love humor. I think one of the better things I ever did as an actor was comedy. And I just had such great fun doing it, and that's how it happened. There's nothing mystical about it. I just enjoy comedy.
Now, the two books that you can't really talk about, can you talk about why you wrote those under a pseudonym, or is that part of what you're not allowed to discuss?
I think it's part of what I'm not supposed to discuss.
Fair enough. Right. Now, your book, The Osterman Weekend, is, I think, the only one of your books so far that was made into a movie. Is that right?
No. There was another one. If it was just The Osterman Weekend, I think I might stop writing. But
you didn't like the movie, huh?
Well, let's put it this way. Nobody tries. You know, a writer can always say no to movies. The reason we don't say no is that we're greedy. And so therefore, you know, we can't sit back and cry. But when they sent me the work print of that, one, I do not write pornography. And they opened with a graphically pornographic scene. And then they sent me a work print. That's how I happened to see it, from the Coast, because they wanted me to do some television and radio interviews with the director. And after 20 minutes, I picked up the phone and booked passage to Hong Kong so I wouldn't be here when it opened. It was and of course, that book is simply a shaggy dog story, a one-act tale that if all these four couples had communicated, nothing would have happened. So what did they do in the movie? They blew up half the couples in halfway through, which of course means they didn't quite understand the book, and nobody bothered to call me. And I never saw the screenplay. And but no, there was another one made, Holcroft Covenant, with Michael Caine. And I actually think that's not bad at all. I think that's that captures a lot of a very, very complicated book. And Michael Caine is marvelous in it.
Yeah, yeah. We only have a couple of seconds left, but would you like to see more movies made from your books?
Well, I think really I fall into the category of miniseries. There's one that's been... No, really, I mean that.
Well, the books are long enough, that's for
sure.
Yeah,
that's what I mean. They've just finished doing The Bourne Identity with Richard Chamberlain and Jacqueline Smith. They just finished filming in Geneva last week, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, and there are others in the works now.
Okay, well, listen, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been writer Robert Ludlum. His new thriller is titled The Icarus Agenda. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.